Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me this week on Tia Time. We'll get to the show in just a moment. First, I wanted to say thank you to all of you who have posted a rating on Apple Podcast. Apple Podcast is an app that can be downloaded to your phone or computer. The algorithm it uses allows more artists and art enthusiasts like yourselves to hear about the show. So if you haven't posted a rating yet, do it now. Thank you. On with the show. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, the weekly podcast where we discuss the methods, challenges, and real-life experiences of living our creative dreams. What kind of creative warrior are you? Musician, filmmaker, painter, choreographer, poet, sculptor, fashionista? Let's talk about it right now. I'm your host, Tia Imani Hanna. This week on Tia Time with Artists, I have a wonderful, outstanding musician, trombonist, and educator, a band leader. He's been mentored by Jackie McLean and Art Blakey and other jazz greats. He's worked with every living jazz icon, some that have passed now, but he, as a side person and to his credit as a band leader, he's got 20 CDs in his discography. Welcome, Steve Davis, or Stevie D, as they call you out there in the world.
Hi, Tia. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today. A Tia time.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. Now, one of the first questions I always ask everybody is, were you a prodigy or were you just, when you came out of the womb, did you say, ooh, music? Or was music in your family? Were you surrounded by it? Were there a lot of musicians around? Was everybody a math teacher? How did you start?
Definitely not math teachers. But I there was always music playing in my household. My parents and especially my dad had a lot of jazz and blues records and rock and roll. And so from an early age, I developed an affinity just for listening to music and enjoying it. And then my grandparents on both sides, my grandsir, my dad's dad, played the trumpet as a hobby. And he loved Duke Ellington and the swing era big bands, Basie and music like that. And then my Nana, my grandmother on my mother's side, we called her Nana, she played the piano. And she was the prodigy, like in my family. She was the natural musician. She never read a note of music her whole life. She never learned to read, but she played stride piano. And yeah, so we'd go visit her. And I have a very, well, many memories, but one that sticks out when I was about 6 years old. And it was just normal to hear my Nana go to the piano and play Honeysuckle Rose or Them Their Eyes or Embraceable You or all these great American songbook standards and swinging. And I had no idea. That was just Nana playing the piano. And I thought, everybody's grandmother sits down and plays piano like that. And then I began to realize nobody's Nana does that, hardly anyone. And one day I just went to the piano with my little index finger down at the bass. I always gravitated to the bass for some reason. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I played boom, do, da, 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 and my Nana came running in from the room.
I bet she did.
She's yelling to my mother, whose name is Sydney. She said, "Did you hear little Stevie? He made the change. He made the change." And I thought, wow, I made the change. And I felt special. Wow, I had no idea what that meant. It was the blues. So I'm very grateful for that influence from my Nana and my parents and my grandparents, my grandsir. But I really just kind of liked music. I didn't take it very seriously until really well into junior high school and later on when I started to really apply myself and realize that I think that this is really the thing for me.
Thank you. you said your dad played the trumpet a little bit. So,
yep, my grandsir played the trumpet. My dad played electric bass as a hobby later. So yeah, there was a I don't even think it was a Fender bass. It was some Korean made bass, electric bass, and I loved that thing. He would allow me to practice on that a little, and there were instruments. We didn't have a piano in the house in my parents' house, but there'd be a guitar or like whatever, a tambourine, just anything you could kind of play around with as a kid. But it took a while for me to get to the trombone. Yeah, that came later. But the trumpet is what I started on. So you were on the right track with that. I chose the trumpet and I got braces. And back in the late 70s, we called them railroad tracks across your teeth. So I wanted to quit halfway through fifth grade because they give you wax to put in your teeth. And
oh,
it was a nightmare. And my mother said, "Yo, you got to go ask your father." I thought, uh-oh. And I asked if I could quit playing. And my director, Mr. Ross, who was an Eastman graduate and a classical brass teacher, he suggested the baritone horn or the and that it would be a little bigger around my lips. It wouldn't cut so much with the braces. And I could still play the same fingerings as trumpet. And so I graduated into the bass clef, if you will, the bass clef club by switching to baritone. And I really fell in love with the sound because I had been like 11th cornet up to that point. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, halfway through fifth grade, I'm the only baritone horn player. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you function like the tuba and other times like the trombones. And then other times you play these hybrid kind of runs with the piccolos and the clarinets. And I thought, wow, this is kind of cool. So yeah, that was a big moment.
You kind of got to be a little bit of a star there because everybody dropped out too. You got to learn it and really experience playing parts that you may not have had if there were more people playing that instrument too. So that's cool.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. So, we already know jazz was in the house. So at this time, were you hanging out with your Nana, and was she playing with you as you went along?
Wow. Yeah. Mostly I would just listen to her. And then when I eventually picked up the trombone, I guess around ninth grade, between eighth and ninth grade, because I wanted to play in the jazz band or the stage band, as they called it in those days. And another director of that group told me, "You're playing baritone. You really should learn slide trombone if you want to play in the band." So I basically, the last day of school, Mr. Ross showed me the correlations from the valves to the slide. Mm. And first position is open, and second position is like the second valve, and third position the first, fourth even with the bell, one and two, and so on. And basically, good luck. And so I took a school horn. I went home that summer, and I was somewhat of a barbarian with the trombone. I had no idea what other than that basic premise. And I was playing along with any music, like Rolling Stones records or you whatever, just whatever I heard and tried to play with the radio. And then shortly after that, my dad had a Horace Silver recording called the Cape Verdean Blues, and I heard J.J. Johnson on that.
Ah, yeah.
Just like a lightning bolt, like, that's a trombone? Oh, my gosh. And I was hooked. Like, that is it. And then right after that, my dad had he recommended to me an Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers recording, Ugetsu, Live at Birdland, featuring the great Curtis Fuller, Detroit's own. My hero and mentor, the great Curtis Fuller. And that was it for me. And then Slide Hampton, later I heard him, and I just thought, I got to try to be a part of this.
That's amazing. I work with a lot of adult students as a violin teacher to teach them beginning instruments. And one of the things that I teach them is a listening technique or active listening, where I have them go through and pick something like a jazz recording or some kind of combo recording, and they listen to the different parts of the band, and they try to separate out the independent parts, and then they try to put them together in combinations of twos and threes and start hearing how they interact. so they can really decode that language. And it sounds like you were doing exactly that when you were playing along with whatever record you could find.
Yeah, that's so wonderful that you do that with young people. And just hearing you talk about, I'm envisioning a sextet, for instance, where you have maybe trumpet and saxophone, tenor, whatever, and trombone, and then piano, bass, and drums. That's a very traditional jazz instrumentation. Mm-hmm. And it's, excuse me, it's making me think and remember fondly in my adult life that my career was going. I was out there playing and had played with Jackie McLean for many years at that point. And then I wound up getting a call from the great Chick Corea and joined his sextet in the late 90s that was called Origin. Okay. And he had alto, tenor, and trombone, and piano, bass, and drums. And then the alto and tenor players, Steve Wilson and Bob Shepard, they would double on various woodwinds. And they're both just virtuoso players who can do all that. And but he, what you made me think of is the way Chick used to talk about it was very similar. He would say, like the combinations within the band, he'd say to us in a very encouraging way, don't necessarily lapse into just playing your part and doing your solo and standing up at the mic and then you're just standing around waiting while other people played. And he said, always be aware, with six of us, there are, at any given point in the music, there are 36 potential combinations. Mm-hmm. Six times six. And I thought, man, that's so obvious, but how come I never thought of that? And it could be the trombone and piano play together for a while. It could be just the bass and drums everyone lays out. It could be bass, drums, and saxophone. It could, you know what I mean? There's so many different possibilities. And that was very liberating to really consider that and not take it for granted. And mm-hmm. just the possibilities and the communication, the lines of connection in a band, it's great.
Yeah, that is one of the key things that I find that mostly, you know, most players, they can play their instrument so well, but they miss that piece. And that's one of the first things I try to teach my students is that you need to listen and support the music and not just play like everybody's a play along. You have to really listen and say, what am I adding? And sometimes what you're adding is silence.
Yeah.
That's a key piece.
Very much so. That's so true. And yeah, that's something I've noticed, Tia, too. There are many very accomplished, great instrumentalists in just in the realm of jazz music or so-called jazz music. But the special ones don't necessarily fill up all the space or have to run all their stuff all the time. It's more of an interaction. I totally agree. And it's very special to hear someone allow their contribution to be framed by the other musicians or addressed, or so you're playing in context together and you're not just running your stuff, as they say. So
yeah, and it keeps you from getting lazy because you have to listen.
Yeah, you got to react and initiate, and it's a conversation. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely a conversation. I think working musicians understand it more because they get to play more. And a lot of folks, we might be pros, but we don't get to play very often because we still have the day gigs and we don't travel. We're in our little towns doing what we do, but it's not the full-time gig. So we don't get as many experiences and we don't understand that necessarily. Some people do, but it's a lot of folks just, you don't, if you don't do it every day, you don't realize sometimes.
Oh yeah. That's true with any discipline or with anything really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And honestly, that's the thing now here in the throes of the pandemic, once again, where you really cherish the opportunities to get together and play. And because they're just not happening as often, they for obvious reasons. And so I think it's given us all a lot of time to reflect and absorb. I know for me at 54 years old, I can look back on the last 35 years and think, wow, Man, if I never got to play again, I sure did have a great time.
Yeah.
And I feel so fortunate and blessed to meet all these incredible musicians over the years and travel and all of it. So when you do get to play your colleagues, your fellow musicians, it's so special. And to work with students and just anybody who's interested in playing and developing as a musician, it's just a treat to be a part of that.
Such a joy. Now, one of the things I noticed, I lived in New York for 11 years, and this is well before COVID. And so this is like from 2000 or 1999 to 2009, I lived in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow. What a great time to be there.
Yeah. But at the same time, there weren't hangs. People didn't hang. I remember I met Esperanza Spalding at Joe's Pub. She was doing a gig with Rhiannon and James Hopgood. He's a piano player. He used to work with Kurt Elling.
Chicago, right?
Yeah, from Chicago, yep. And they were at Joe's Pub, and at intermission, I was talking to her, and this is right before she blew up. And she said, "Where do people hang?" And I'm like, "There really isn't a hang." Because I guess in Seattle, people hung out and played all the time. And at that time, it was like only the late night thing at Smalls, I think.
Yeah.
And that was it in the whole city. It was like crazy.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's not like it was back in the day where there were house parties and there were loft. Like I've talked to a lot of musicians about the loft scene in the 70s, 60s, 70s. Yeah. People would play for days. This jam session just going on. I think you can still find some of that, but I'm sure it's not as prevalent as it once was. And I'm not quite sure why that is. Fortunately, there still are clubs. I lived in Hartford, Connecticut for many years, and I would bounce in and out of New York all the time. It's only a couple hours. And we used to, up there with the musicians in that community, during the same years you're talking about, and even back in the 90s when I moved back up there, we would just make places to play, just convert a restaurant or whatever, and to just ask them, "Hey, can you let us try this?" And it would take off usually, and you develop a following, and people wanted to come and hang, and whether they were there to listen and socialize or all the musicians. And I was always trying to do my part to center some venues and just some situations like that so we could all develop and grow and share the music. It's so important to what we do.
This, we're talking about the past days. Now, I lived in Lansing too. I went to Michigan State University. So in East Lansing, they have Rodney Whitaker runs that jazz department up there. Yeah. So he has his students, and they have a couple of different places that small pubs that run jazz like one day a week or something like that, which is great. And so they do have a hang in that sense. But I found that there was more of a hang in Lansing than there was in New York. And that really surprised me.
Yeah. The Professor Whitaker does an amazing job there. He had me out a few years ago with Mike Dees and Xavier Davis and just all the great faculty there. Uncle G, Randy Gillespie. What a treasure he is. And just really amazing students. The Bebop Spartans. I love it. We had such a great time. I think that was March of 18 or 19, seems like yesterday. And my wife, Abana, came with me, and she got to do some singing, too, with us. And we just had an absolutely wonderful time.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
For our listeners, I just want them to have an idea of some of the different things that people do. Like, you had that idea. Like, we used to just ask the guy, "Hey, you want music here?" And start something. And they said, "Fine." And even in these COVID times, I think anything that's going to bring more business into a place is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
So it's worth trying to create a hang. And the world is a little bit different because people are a little bit more, I think, digitally linked now. They're on their phones and they're on their laptops and that sort of thing. But I think people crave the company of other people.
Yes.
As we are in lockdown. So I think that it's probably a good time maybe to try to start some different things. And especially as the summer comes up, you can have outdoor things happen.
Yeah. And I experienced that just last summer and in the summer of 20. where, you know, once the weather got nice around Connecticut and the greater New York area, people were playing outdoor gigs, concerts all over the place. And you're right, people were craving just to come out and be together. You could feel it. It was a beautiful experience. And hopefully when we finally get through the worst of this pandemic and find a way to live with it and get things functioning again in a little more normal way, we'll really appreciate these years and probably never take it for granted again, just playing music, any kind of social activity like that, where we can be together and talk and laugh and just, you really miss that. You're right. And in this digital situation that we're in so often, you do crave that company and just being around people. It's just wonderful. And for jazz music, it's vital.
Yes.
To what we do. It really is.
It really is. So now, okay, let's get back to you a little bit more history. You studied with Jackie McLean and worked with him as well, and Art Blakey and Chick Corea. Yeah. When these things were happening, were you like petrified when you first met them? Because they're nice guys and everything, but oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Definitely that. But then over time, and all the other situations that I've been so fortunate to be involved with, where you just at some point accept that, yeah, I'm supposed to be here. I guess I'm supposed to be part of this. And you look around and, man, like the Dizzy Gillespie All-Star Big Band in the 2000s, like the years you were living in Brooklyn, we used to play. We had tours and stuff, but we played a couple times a year at the Blue Note and for a week. And I was playing in the trombone section and Slide Hampton sitting next to me playing a trombone. And right in front of me is Jimmy Heath's back. I'm playing and then Frank West. Moody. And how did I get here? And this was well into my career, so, you know, about 20 years ago. But it always feels that it's just a dream come true when you get to play with your mentors and heroes and fellow musicians of my generation. There's so many great ones. And then some of the up-and-comers now, just fantastic players. And we all just love to do it. So sure, in the early days, I was nervous, definitely. But then you just realize you're supposed to be there. And you just try to enjoy it and add what you can. And keep learning, keep working on it.
With all the touring and all the stuff that's going on, I know when you first started, you had probably a pretty strict regimen of trying to get things learned because you just didn't have them yet because you were young. So as you get older into your craft, what kind of things do you do now just to keep the chops up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I some days I force myself to do long tones and a brass trombone sort of workout, even if it's 30 minutes, a routine, so that you keep that relationship with your embouchure, with the horn in your hands. Usually I practice longer than that, maybe an hour and a half or something, a couple hours, and that's usually good. And there's nothing like the real thing, like playing for real with the bands and whatever the setting is. One thing I do when I have something coming up and they might send some music ahead of time to learn, or if it's a big band situation where you have a lot of written parts to play, I'll just play through the book and play through it again, and it just works your chops and you mold your chops to that particular set of music for that gig. When I don't have anything to work on, I love my ball games. I'm a big baseball, basketball, football guy. And actually, Mr. Sam gave me his Detroit Tigers mug.
Oh, okay.
You might recognize this. So, okay. Yeah, so I had to drink this while I saw you today. So I drink coffee out of here. So,
that's great.
Talk baseball, and yesterday I was watching Big East college basketball games, and of course, being a Connecticut guy all these years, I got my UConn Huskies close by always.
Okay.
But and my dad went to Syracuse, and my brothers, I'll watch whatever game is on and get my horn out and just practice. Just I'll play along with commercials on TV. Like you hear some silly music, but what key is it in? Okay, E minor. Okay, this one's D major. Oh, this one went to A flat. Oh, wow. And you keep your brain sharp. And yeah, I'll practice new things, different kind of systems or patterns musically, or just play through various chord qualities, either scales or arpeggios. I love the piano. I love to sit at the piano and play chords and compose music. I love to write tunes and compositions and just learn standards. The American Songbook is always waiting for you, just beckoning. If you can remember some tunes you used to kind of know, and that kind of thing. Or do you know the verse? A lot of people don't play the verses out in front of the standards. And there's just such a vast ocean of music any day that you can just decide you're gonna explore. But some days, especially during the pandemic times, it's hard to get motivated. Mm-hmm. We're all human. But I'm fortunate. My wife, Abana, will tell me, she'll be working on something and she'll just casually ask, you know, she'll say, did you do your long tones yet? She said, you better get on that horn. And so it really helps to have somebody in your corner like that who really gets it. And she's a great musician herself. And she used to play the trombone years ago, actually. So she knows. When she tells me that, she knows what she's saying to me.
Right. So. And you're like, ooh, did she hear something I didn't hear?
She knows my sound. And if I try different mouthpieces or something, she'll listen and say, that one sounds like somebody trying to sound like you. I'll say, well, yeah, this is a new one. She'll say, well, why don't you put Old Faithful back in? I'll play my usual mouthpiece. That's you. And so it's fun. Yes. We have a great time digging music together. And yeah, it's great.
Do you ever just write in the air with no instrument?
I love it. I love your questions. Yes, sometimes. We live in Stamford, Connecticut, so we live on Bedford Street for about 4.5 years in downtown Stamford, which is like 45 minutes from New York City north. So a lot of trains. It's very convenient to get in and out of town and pretty much anywhere in southern New England, upstate New York. So we live on Bedford Street, and I wrote a tune. Exactly what you described, just walking down the street in the air, and I heard a little melody and started thinking about some chords. I like to walk sometimes, and then things come to you, and then I'll come back home, get to the piano and flesh it out. And I was like, wow, this is going to work. And I can drop these chords underneath and then I take it here, and all of a sudden it takes shape. And I called it Bedford Stroll. It just feels so natural. It's, this is how it's supposed to be. You get inspired. Mm-hmm. Who knows where that comes from? It's, to me, it has to be some spiritual energy beyond any one person. It's beyond us. And I'm trying to be just a good host to the notes. Because those notes are passing through. They've been around way before us, and they're going to be around way after we're out of here. So I just try to be a good host to the notes.
A lot of the stuff I've written has been on a stroll. I used to go through walks through Prospect Park. That I created a couple different things that way. And I'm just like, okay, this is a gospel tune. Okay, here you go. And it just kept going. It's like I had, then I would have a part and I would just sing that one part over and over. And then three more parts came in. Okay, now this goes there. And then I have the shape of the thing. And I'm like, okay, now what kind of instrumentation? It's this and this. And it's amazing how that works. But a lot of times I really feel like I am just listening. Like it's on the air. It's on the wind. And I'm just catching it. Like the angels are singing it. And I'm just trying to listen. And it's really hard to hear it. But you got to pull it out. And you're just trying to copy it down before it appears.
Yeah, I totally get it. I love it. Sometimes the impetus can be just a certain type of chord. Like you sit down and play, you're in a sort of minor mood, play F minor 11 or something, and just let it sit there. Then you move it around and you might find different. I love chord progressions and chord changes. It's just a beautiful chord changes. And I think the melodies can rise out of those, like out of the terrain or the soil of the of the harmony. And then these beautiful melodies can grow out of those. But sometimes, like you say, you hear a melody just in the wind that you're trying to catch. And it's free. It's kind of like a freer thing. It could be a bass line. It could be a rhythmic figure, some kind of groove or some jagged hits, or it you don't know, like you don't know what's gonna be the impetus or the inspiration or that spark for your creativity, but it sure is fun trying.
It is one of the things. There's one of my teachers here, Robert Pifo, is a vibraphone and piano player, and he taught me about the cycle of fourths and fifths. I think mostly they just call it the cycle of fifths, but it depends on which direction you go around the circle. And the jazz people go around the fourth side because they always go through the flats first. So I always learned it that way. You know, and the violin players would learn it the other way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So now I've been trying to write a lot of things that just go through the cycle because there's just so much there.
Oh, yeah.
Just basically just that. I don't have to invent anything new.
You're right. I can, because you can find new things in that format. Yeah, I agree. In terms of writing and also being an improviser, I think the more I go along this journey, sure, I want to try to find some kind of different angles or something that's hip or a little off the beaten path or that feels fresh or new. But mostly, I just want to write and play something beautiful. And I'm definitely a melodist. I love melodies and beautiful sounding music. And I enjoy writing some tunes that might feel familiar. Man, I feel like I heard this before, but you really haven't. But it's got that tradition in it. It's got the history in it. And I just feel compelled that way. Other people, other musicians express it differently. And that's why we all need each other. We have all those different approaches and personalities. That's what makes it all. That's what makes us people. And hopefully a beautiful society. We're, I guess I've had my doubts in the last 4 or 5 years, but yeah. But we're hanging in there and trying to get it, make it.
So what have you been working on? What's your most recent release that you have out there?
Oh, I'll tell you one release that I'm sure that you know about, that I'm very excited about, is playing on your aunt Naima Chambergé's new CD.
That's right.
And I would love to talk about that just a little bit because it's so personal for us. And I met her, Naima, through Larry Willis, the great pianist. And Larry and I were very close for about 20 years. And he was Uncle Larry to my kids. He used to stay at the house up in Hartford. And we did a lot of playing together, whether it was his band or groups that I led. And so I think it was 2010, maybe. Larry called and said, "Hey, Stevie D, I've got a gig for us in Baltimore at the UB Blake Center." Mm-hmm. I think it was just quartet. I don't think we had Joe Ford, the great alto player, on that gig. It was just me. And then he said, "And it's with a vocalist that I work with from time to time. She's great. You're going to dig her. She's from Detroit. Her name is Naima Chambergé." Oh, great. So we met at that gig, and I met Sham, was there too. Mm-hmm. And we just hit it off, and it was a wonderful gig. We had a great time. The venue was great. The UB Blake Center, the audience loved it. And I was just so delighted to be a part of it, and that was that. And so every now and then, Larry would mention Naima to me, that he had spoken to her or had done a project with her. And then, about a year ago, out of the blue, I got a phone call from Naima. And she said, "I don't know if you remember me." I said, "Of course I do." And this is 10 years later. And then she put Mr. Sham on the phone. And he really laid it out and said, "My wife's working on her recent project. And I told her, you got to get that horn, man. That trombone. They played with you with Larry Willis in Baltimore. What's his name? Davis? Yeah." And I thought, what an honor, like, to be thought of all these years later. Mm-hmm. And so I drove out to Detroit with Abana. She was off from teaching, and we just made a trip of it. And I went in the studio with Naima and got to overdub for part of the session. I overdubbed some solos that they had left space for me to play on. And it just went down so smoothly. The repertoire was so good. The rhythm section was swinging. It was just easy to do, and we had a ball. And then I got to play some other horn parts the next day, and it was just with the horn section, and it was just fantastic. And so I'm very excited about Naima's CD, and she's a real legend in Detroit. And so I think that's coming out pretty soon.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, and I'm just so happy to get to know both of them, and you. And man, when Sham told me he went to high school with Paul Chambers and Doug Watkins, those were his best buddies. And I just thought, you tell me about the first time you met Curtis Fuller and Frank Rosalino and all the Kenny Burrell, the names, and just the incredible Detroit history. That's been a real treat to talk about all that. And
yeah, he's a jazz encyclopedia, that one.
He loves it. He really knows this music.
He does.
On a very acute level.
He lived this music. So, yeah, for sure.
And then I'll be recording something new for Smoke Sessions, the label, the Smoke Jazz Club record label in New York, sometime this year. So there'll be something new coming out later in 22. We were talking about it last week, so we're kicking around some ideas. But the last record I put out was called Correlations, and that was in 2019, I believe. So it's
like it's ancient history or anything.
no, but it feels like a long time. But I have played on some other recordings during the pandemic and different things. And yeah, and so some recording sessions, some gigs. I'm actually playing later this week. Today's Sunday, with great musicians at the Jazz at Lincoln Center in New York. They're doing a tribute to Chick Corea, part of that. So that's going to be wonderful. I'm looking forward to that this week and a few things here and there, trying to stay busy. And I actually had a transcription book just come out from a record I did called Getting It Done for the Positone label. And that was around 2011, I think we recorded that. And so a young trombonist from Kansas City, who's Brian Scarborough, very diligent, studious young man. And he transcribed all my solos from this one record and approached me about releasing it as a book, a transcription book for trombonists. And we worked on it just the past several months, and he was really diligent, and it moved quickly, and he was very thorough, and got a few photos in there from the date. And Larry Willis plays on that record too. Mm-hmm. And my dear friend Nat Reeves, the great bassist from Hartford. And so that's just been released. So to all the jazz trombonists out there who are curious, there's a book called Getting It Done.
Fantastic.
I'm excited about that too.
That's great. Now, is there, out of all the stuff that you've done like myriads of music and recordings and things, is there any one that just sticks out in your mind more than anything else over time?
Ooh, that's a tough question because there are many. Going back to my early in my career to have the privilege to play with Jackie McLean, there was a record called Rhythm of the Earth that we did. I was very young, and Roy Hargrove was on there too. And oh, wow. But over the years, wow, there have just been so many great moments. I did do a recording in 2007. That's called one came out. It's called Eloquence, and it features the great Hank Jones, another of the great Detroit musicians. And then we had so much fun at that date. I thanked Mr. Jones at the end of the session, and it was a dream come true to record with him. He was about 88 years old at the time.
Wow.
And he shakes my hand, and I'm like 41 or so at this point. And he says, "Why, Stevie?" Well, the way he spoke, he was very proper. You know?
Yes, yes.
"Why, Stevie, we had so much fun. I think perhaps we ought to do it again." I went to the producer, John Lee, was producing it, the bassist from who played with Dizzy Gillespie. And he was starting his new label. I said, "John, Mr. Jones would like to do something else." And so we went back out to John Lee's living room, and he had a nice piano, a nice setup. And this time it was just Peter Washington on the bass and myself and Hank Jones, just trio. Mm-hmm. No drums, just the three of us. And it was magic. It was just so easy to play, and I can't even describe the thrill of playing with Hank Jones, and just everything makes sense. He's such a master accompanist and soloist, just the whole thing. So we prepared some mostly standards. I had some ideas. He had some ideas. Peter had some ideas. And we just breezed through this program, and it never came out. And then the session was feared lost for a time on the hard drive. But it was recovered recently. And I'm so glad. So I've been revisiting that. And I think that will be released. If it's not my next record, it will be the one after, but on the Smoke label. We've been trying to mix it a little bit and just touch it up and get it ready. So that date, I'm very proud of. And I'm so happy that it actually might come out now. And
great.
It was so easy to play. And Peter Washington and I were just almost beside ourselves. And Peter's such a master. He's played with everybody. And so to be with both of them, I just admire them both so much as musicians and gentlemen of jazz. And it was just so fun to do it.
Oh, it sounds like it was a dream. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's one of those things. I know Naeem and Sham told you my uncle was Sir Roland Hanna. And I didn't get to know him very well until I moved to New York, and that was pretty much near the end of his life. So I didn't really get to know him that well. But I showed him what I was working on, and he approved of some of the tunes I wrote, which was great. He played cello as well. And yeah, that was his other love. And I got to play with him on the cello, but I never got to play with him when he was playing piano. Oh. It was, really? You're not going to play piano with me?
Man, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's so, right. He's Nolan Hanna's your uncle. That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah. He was interesting because I learned some interesting things from him. I remember going up to, because he had a little, I guess they call it the ranch or the farm or whatever, because it was a large place. He would be watching movies, but he would be turning channels. And I'm like, what are you looking for? I asked him, like, what are you, because he kept turning the channels. He said, oh, I'm just listening to the music.
Yeah.
He wouldn't watch it unless it had good music, whatever it was, because he's listening to the soundtrack. And I'm like, that's interesting. And I said, so then I started really paying attention to that more.
Yeah, I totally believe that. And I've done that myself. It's amazing, some of the film scoring that over the years. It's unbelievable music. Yeah.
It's very true. And because he wrote a lot of classical to jazz stuff.
Yeah.
That never got recorded. And I got a chance to transcribe a lot of that stuff for him.
Wow.
But so all my lessons with him were just little bits like that, you know? And I was like, what should I do? Because I was trying to learn how to improvise at that time and get some fluidity with it. And he was like, somebody told me that Jamie Ebersold, I think, was saying, learn 50 tunes or something like that in every key. And he says, well, don't learn 50, just learn 10.
Yes. Start with one, you know? Yeah, and then moving into different keys will, that takes you all through the instrument and through the harmony. Each key kind of has its own personality or color. And for the trombone, there are certain shapes on the horn. If you're dealing with whatever it may be, like a major 9, major 7 with a 9 or whatever, and you're going up and down, and maybe for 3 in a row, you can play the same shape. Like almost like a capo on a guitar neck. And then at some point you run out of real estate and you got to switch the shape up. And then you follow that shape for a while. And I remember, I always think about this, just how it feels. And this is why it's important to play and practice a lot, because you're dealing with muscle motor memory and just having those things just be there for you to create with in the moment when you're improvising. And that's something I've, over the years of teaching, where I've it's been my job not only to be a player and performer, but bring it back to the classroom and share with the students. And I benefited from Jackie McLean, Professor McLean, doing that years ago. And we have carried on that tradition at the Hart School at the University of Hartford. I've taught there for 30 years now. And people say, yeah, man, it's your 31st year. And I'm like, no, it's not. You got the wrong guy. But somehow that's happened. I've taught and played my whole life. I owe Dr. McLean, Jackie McLean, and his wife, Dolly McLean. They're so wonderful. And I owe them a great deal for that opportunity, opening those doors to me. And it's been a way of life to play and teach and play and teach. And it's all related. And I like talking about improvising as being available in the moment.
No. Yeah, it's truly a thrill to do that. The band that I had most recently, that's what we do. We just go on the stage and say, what do you feel like? Boom, and we go. Wow. So the whole show is that. And it started out as just trying to teach myself how to improvise. But now it's, okay, how do we do that with a group? And then I got a chance to perform with Bobby McFerrin, which was awesome. And then I finally felt like, okay, it was what you said earlier, is I do need to be here. He gave me his stage over and over during that show. So yeah. I'm like, okay, so obviously I'm at the level. I'm at a level. So.
Right. This is happening for a reason.
Yeah.
And just enjoy it. Easier said than done sometimes. And oh, believe me, I got to play a little bit with Bobby McFerrin through Chick Corea, because Bobby would sit in sometimes wherever we were playing. It could be Europe. He would just be there.
Show up. Yeah.
And I remember just the way he and Chick, like you said, would just boom. They would just start, like, just start playing, hitting notes, singing notes. The way they bounced around off of each other.
Yeah.
Unbelievable, man. And Steve Wilson, the great saxophonist, my dear friend. And there were times where Chick would be playing, like with Bobby, or more frequently, the duos with Gary Burton, the great vibe. And they sounded so good. Steve and I would be listening from the wings of the stage and then getting ready to come back out with Origin with the sextet. And we would just look at each other and say, "What? Why are we playing after this?" You know, and we would just laugh and say, "Oh, Chick Watts is here. We got to do something." And there were times where Chick was playing and I would go stand behind him and just watch his hands. And I did this with Larry Willis, with the great Harold Mayburn. I used to watch his hands. And, oh, man, do I miss Mabes and Larry. And just because I would hear these chords while I was playing coming from that big 9-foot Yamaha grand concert grand piano, and Chick's looking at you, bang, and he'd hit this chord that sounded like B-flat, everything. And I'm like, wow. And then one day I went to watch how he voiced. I said, oh, that's what they call double diminished. That's F, A flat, B, D, and then E, G, B flat, D flat right on top. Yeah. Bang. And it just, and then he'd hit that chord and give you that look like, okay.
What like, you going to do now?
Let's play, baby. Just, and it was just unbelievable. He encouraged you to be creative all the time. And what a ride it's been to just have the privilege of being around musicians like him and Jimmy Heath. James Moody, Cedar Walton. Oh
wow.
Yeah, it's too much. Sometimes I'm like, man, wait, was that me? Like, what would do? Was I really there for these things? So during this time, Tia, I'm enjoying absorbing it and reflecting and trying to appreciate the music and my life and all of it on a deeper level, and then practice, keep your chops up. Write, compose, study, read, enjoy yourself, have fun, watch your ball games, watch your movies, whatever, and then get ready for the next stuff. And so I can really make the most of it and appreciate all the musicians and the music even more. Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for those words of wisdom in the stories. And where can people find you online?
Oh, they can find me on Facebook and Instagram. I'm not super active with social media, but I'm there. And I do have a website. It's www.stevedavismusic.com. People can look me up those ways, and I'd love to hear from anyone who's interested and just wants to talk about music. It'd be great.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to be getting back with you. We're going to talk about the cycle and some active listening.
Great. I look forward to it, Tia, and I look forward to digging your music more. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at iTunes Podcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate your comments, and we will mine them to bring you more amazing episodes. I would like to thank this season's sponsors. Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, is a partner in supporting the Tia Time podcast, and Greg Hill's Cold Plunge Records. Without their support, this podcast would not be possible. Thank you so very, very much. If you would also like to contribute to the show, you can find us on www.patreon.com/TiaTime1. That's Tia Time, the number one. To continue the conversation about topics discussed on this show or start new ones with like-minded people, join us at the Tia Time Lounge on Facebook. Thank you for listening. See you next week at Tia Time. Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tia Time.